My new podcast series, Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm, is now live on drstreicher.substack.com. There will be a total of 32 episodes exploring loss of libido, pain with sexual activity, and postmenopause difficulty with orgasm. If you're looking for hormonal and non-hormonal solutions to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up, check it out. The link is in the program notes. Today is Q&A day, a roundup of your questions, and I have invited Dr. Heidi Flagg to the conversation. I'm Dr. Lauren Streicher, gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices, and I'm here to give you the inside information. I get lots of questions. Some are from people who record a question on my website, drstreicher.com. Some are questions from my Substack subscribers. I mean, I do an Ask Me Anything webinar each month, but we never get to all of them. Ditto. I just finished taping a Q&A for Mentors, which is an educational platform for midlife women that has classes taught by the best menopause experts. And even though I answered roughly 30 questions, I didn't get to all of them. So I keep lists and lists of questions. And today, I'm going to work my way through as many questions as possible. I've asked my friend and colleague, Dr. Heidi Flagg, to join me because it's always good to get another point of view. And Dr. Flagg is, above all, a clinician. She is in her office in New York City, day in and day out, helping women navigate perimenopause and postmenopause. And unlike a lot of people out there who are new to the scene, Dr. Flagg brings decades of real-world experience to the table. So welcome, Dr. Flagg.
Thank you so much, Dr. Streicher. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I appreciate it.
You know, we actually talk a lot, but we don't get to be in the same room very often. In fact, I'm pretty sure the last time we were actually physically together was at South by Southwest last year when we were both on menopause panels.
I think that's right, which was a year ago, which is astounding because I do feel like I'm connected with you pretty constantly. I want anyone of my patients particularly to know who might be listening to this to know that it's not just my brain at work when I give them advice. I'm talking to you and getting advice from you and recommendations. So, you know, there are multiple brains helping those patients through their struggles. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that's really true of all the menopause experts. And every day, all day, you know, we're kind of shooting each other texts and saying, hey, I have this complex situation. You want to weigh in on it because I think I know how I want to approach it, but I'd love to hear what you have to say. All right, let's do this. I'm just excited to read the recorded questions instead of playing the recordings because quite frankly, it's quicker and then we can make it through more stuff. I don't know if we're going to get through it all, but hey, why not? All right, this one came from Karen and her question is, do you need to be 12 months without a period to start taking hormone therapy? So what's your answer to that?
That's a classic. And it's really important to understand that perimenopause starts long before you've been without a period for a full year, right? So we know that menopause is when you haven't had a period for a year. These are basic definitions. But the preamble, and somebody, a comedian I heard just the other day, called it the amuse-bouche, is perimenopause, which of course can last anywhere from 4 to 10 or 12 years, right? So that can start in your late 30s and lead up to the 51 and a half mark where the average age of 1 year without a period. So, and many of those perimenopausal symptoms, the suffering happens in perimenopause, as you and I both know, right? Yeah. There's the early phase and the late phase, and women suffer tremendously and they don't quite know what's going on. And it's really important to offer up hormone therapy and options to mitigate and optimize how they're feeling.
Yeah, totally agree. But I mean, here's the thing. I mean, one of the things about the definition of menopause, which is highly problematic in many ways, you know, to mention a lot of women don't even get periods because they've had a hysterectomy. But even someone who does get periods, this is a retrospective diagnosis. So if someone has been 4 or 5 months without a period and they're having hot flashes and they can't sleep and they're miserable, I can't tell you how often women go to their doctors and they're told, well, no, you have to be 12 months without a period before I start to treat you. And that's just wrong. I mean, it's not my approach, certainly. I don't think it's your approach. And I'd like to hear when you start treatment, but my approach is whenever you're having symptoms that are bothersome to you, even if you're still getting periods, even if it hasn't been a full 12 months, if you're miserable, if you're having things that are really getting in the way of your ability to function in the world, well, then it's time to start talking hormones.
Right. We're talking about really busy women in the middle of their life that are working and have partners and have young kids and aging parents, and they're not sleeping, which is a huge problem. And it's just really important to hear that and allow them to speak about it and then offer up treatment. And I offer up treatment long before the last period, for sure. Yeah,
Your point, perimenopause hits at a very inconvenient time. I mean, really? Do you really have to go through these hormonal fluctuations at the same time that you're dealing with the parents that are aging and the husband that's having the affair and the stuff? I mean, it's just the timing is really, really wrong.
Terrible.
Really wrong. So that kind of leads me on to the next question, which is kind of along the same lines. This was actually an anonymous person. She didn't give her name. And she said, I'm getting a period every 3 to 4 months, so I assume I'm in perimenopause. Okay. And I'm having a lot of symptoms. So I went to my doctor and she suggested I go on birth control pills. I'm not even having sex, so I don't need birth control. I told her I wanted hormone therapy, but she said, no, birth control pills would be better. So should I see a menopause expert?
I mean, the answer is if you can find one, absolutely, right? The drop off in education in terms of menopause care, how many residents get trained? Very few, 10% or something, right? There's been no training in our medical system. So unfortunately, to offer up different options of actual hormone therapy, people, doctors simply and clinicians simply don't know how to do it. Yes, let's hear
it. I 100% agree that most doctors are not trained in menopause, and that if your doctor doesn't seem to know anything about it or what they're doing, absolutely they need to get in the hands of a menopause expert. But in general, women who are perimenopausal and still getting periods who are told to go on a low-dose birth control pill, that's actually appropriate advice, you know, because a lot of women think it's time for hormone therapy, not understanding that birth control pills are hormone therapy. And in fact, during perimenopause, it can be the best form of hormone therapy. Why? Because your own ovaries are confused. Your estrogen levels are up and down and all over the place. And sometimes we do give a low-dose birth control pill to basically say to your ovaries, hey, you guys are confused. You take a break. I'm going to take it from here and give very even amounts of estrogen and progesterone that is not only going to get rid of these symptoms, but may control these out of, you know, whack periods. I think the real issue here is not that she wasn't offered the right treatment, but she wasn't offered a real explanation.
An explanation. Exactly.
I mean, you know, women go to their doctors and they're told, oh, just go on birth control pills. And they think that they're being dismissed, when in fact, most menopause experts are going to say that for a lot of women in perimenopause, that a low dose birth control pill is actually the best approach. So, you know,
I agree with that. I agree with that. You're right. Yes, of course. Yeah. And I do offer, in fact, I often say that my favorite thing to do from your 40 to 50s is put you on, you know, I happen to love loloestrin, a super low dose birth control pill, just to steady the ship so that they're getting exactly the same estrogen, progesterone every day. And it tamps down those highs in early perimenopause, particularly. This is also sort of a myth, right? Perimenopause can be characterized as much higher elevations of estrogen on certain days. And estrogen, of course, has a half-life of only, you know, 12, 24 hours. So then within 12, 24 hours, you can then sink back down to the basement, right? So that birth control pill can tamp down those highs and sort of fill in those lows and give a nice steady state. Yes, they're not being dismissed. It's actually a really good approach.
So we're not really disagreeing. I was just saying, you know, we're in agreement that if clearly her doctor seems clueless about all this stuff, you get in the hands of an expert. But in many cases, a birth control pill is the appropriate thing. Not to mention, we always forget that while fertility is really low during perimenopause, it's not no fertility, it's low fertility. And people do get pregnant. And in fact, 50% of pregnancies that occur over the age of 40 are unplanned. If you're 16 and you get pregnant, it very often will go to viability unless you terminate the pregnancy. Whereas if you get pregnant at 44, 45, in most cases, nature's going to take care of it. Those are mostly miscarriages. But still, the point is that you cannot just assume that contraception is not needed. So
exactly. And then, of course, there's a higher risk of twins because you're hyper-ovulating, right? So that's another.
That's really a good point that you make, because everyone always thinks of this as being a time when, estrogen levels are really low. And as you pointed out, perimenopause, it's a roller coaster. And sometimes you get really high estrogen levels, which is why you might superovulate and get a couple of eggs there. It's why some people get exaggeration of PMS and breast tenderness and all of that. So that's why we talk about low-dose birth control pills, because it really does suppress what your own ovaries are doing and basically take control of the situation. And the other thing that's out there that people don't understand is they have this idea, because we use the word low-dose birth control pills, they think that hormone therapy is higher than birth control pills. And no, birth control pills are obviously much, much higher than hormone therapy is.
Right, to the tune of four to five times the amount of estrogen, at least.
But the other way that I also start this conversation about birth control pills during perimenopause, when someone says, I want hormone therapy, and I say, and I'm going to give you hormone therapy. Birth control pills are hormone therapy.
I've heard you say in your podcast, it's actually the most common hormone therapy that we prescribe, right? And it's absolutely correct, right? It's estrogen and progesterone.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Very common.
Yep. All right. Next question.
Wonderful tool. Yes.
All right. I'm 48 years old. Had a hysterectomy 5 years ago because of fibroids. Now having hot flashes, brain fog, and mood swings. So her question is what hormone levels should I check to see if I'm ready for hormone therapy? Take it away, none. Dr. Flagg. What would you do with this patient?
None. I'd offer her a transdermal patch, gel, oral estradiol. She does not have a uterus at this point, so that does make things somewhat easier. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I won't prescribe progesterone in that case, but I would talk to her about her sleep, but I would certainly just start with some estrogen.
I'm pretty much, with you on this one. And when people say, what hormone level should I check? I always answer, you should get your thyroid check, because so many people have these kinds of symptoms, which are very similar to symptoms that you might get with hypothyroidism. And hypothyroidism is very common at this time of life. But assuming that thyroid levels are where they should be, it is absolutely appropriate to start estrogen. It doesn't matter. When someone says, how do I know if I'm perimenopause or postmenopause? It doesn't matter, because if you don't have a uterus, we don't need to worry about the progesterone or the progesterone substitute. We can just give estrogen to get rid of the symptoms. So really all I care about is the symptoms. Not to mention, if someone's perimenopausal, getting hormone levels can be misleading because, like we were just talking about, they're up and down and all over the place. But let's circle back to the whole progesterone issue, because if the purpose of giving progesterone or a progesterone alternative is to protect the lining of the uterus, because if you give estrogen alone, you can get a buildup, which over time increases the risk of either uterine precancer or cancer. But if someone has had a hysterectomy, if they don't have a uterus, well, then they don't need the progesterone. Yet you mentioned that you will sometimes prescribe a progesterone. So talk about that a little.
I will. And I usually start it with sort of a layered approach, if you will. In this case that you just presented, obviously I need a lot more information, but I would start with just the estrogen and then I would check back in with her. Follow-up is really important when you start these hormones. Maybe check in with them again in 2 to 3 months and see how they're doing. And there is some, pretty decent data with micronized progesterone, the biosimilar progesterone type, that it helps in the GABA region of the brain and helps sort of with an anxiolytic, if you will, and will help people with insomnia and sleeping. So sometimes I'll add that back in if that seems to be a prevailing symptom.
Yeah. Which is absolutely appropriate. My only problem with that is, as you know, so often it's the progesterone that people don't tolerate that makes them bloated or makes them moody. So, I kind of feel like, all right, if they're not sleeping, progesterone is not going to be my first go-to. It's going to be one of my last. And I'm going to look at things like, are you flashing during the night? Do you have aches and pains that are bugging you? Sleep apnea. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying it's the rare person that does not have a uterus that I'm going to give progesterone to. But I mean, there are a lot of people that their approach is way more to like, hey, let's add a little progesterone in.
Right. And it's not, and I made it sound too simplistic. You're absolutely right. You have to look at other reasons for insomnia. Urinary frequency, needing to go to the bathroom, all of those things can be things that wake you up.
The snorer in the bed next to you, there's that too.
But, or the dog, right?
Yeah, the dog, right. But I also think it's worth mentioning the alcohol issue, because we know that women are increasingly drinking midlife and postmenopause. Sometimes it's just social. It's, they're more their lifestyle now. The kids are out of the house and they're going out to dinner and all that more. But a lot of times women are drinking to help them get to sleep. And then, of course, they wake up in the middle of the night. And so,
and of course, we just had that FDA warning, right? We do know that it increases the risk for multiple cancers.
I think it's up to 8 cancers now or something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Penny, she wants to know, she says, I've been using an estrogen patch for about 3 months now, still having hot flashes. Do I need to give it more time or do I need a higher dose of estrogen?
Right. It's a great question. And again, this goes back to the follow-up, right? It's important. Whenever I start someone, I follow them up at least in the 3-month window, 2 to 3 months. I would probably just increase your dose.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that's an important point is how long does it take for estrogen to kick in? Because, you know, we write these prescriptions, we tell people to start. And then I think we have to manage expectations and say, look, this is not going to work overnight. You know, you are certainly hopefully going to be sleeping better and have a reduction in your hot flashes within a week or so. But if a week or two from now, you're still not where you want to be, it doesn't mean we change the dose. You know, I tell people, give it a minimum of 2 months before we start messing with the dose. How about you?
Yeah, exactly the same. And it's thing, you know, I will have a small number of patients that say they feel a difference within 48 to 72 hours. But I definitely give them that full 2 months before. And I set that expectation when I start the prescription with them. I call it my chess move. One of my patients said the other day, which was so great. She's like, you're tinkering, Dr. Flagg. I'm like, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm tinkering. They said,
all right. So let me ask you this, because there's two approaches. Let's say you have someone who comes in who's really flashing. I mean, we're talking one of these super flashers, you know, 30 flashes a day. She's really miserable. One school of thought is to start on the low side with your estrogen, whatever you're using. It doesn't matter, patch, oral, gel, whatever, and then bump it up over time. And the other approach is to start high and to knock out the flashes and then maybe go down. I take the start high and knock them out and go down. Which approach do you take?
I do the exact same thing when somebody's so miserable. And by the way, I just want to point out that if somebody really is having severe hot flashes like that, that's an increased risk and a red flag for potential cardiovascular disease, right? I wonder if they have a history of preeclampsia and other sort of soft markers for cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. It's so funny that you bring that up because I'm just writing a Substack article on how obstetric complications are a forewarning of cardiovascular stuff down the road, like preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, and all of that. But look, these hot flashes are not harmless. There's a very high association with women that have moderate to severe persistent hot flashes and cardiovascular disease down the road. So this isn't just about tough it out and dress in layers. It's we really need to do something, whether it's hormonal or non-hormonal, to get rid of these hot flashes, you know, so that you are not increasing your risk of cardiovascular stuff down the road. But there's another issue with this question that's interesting with the estrogen patch, and she says she's still having hot flashes. I think now we are becoming more aware that there are some people that just don't absorb transdermal estrogen very well. And I don't know if you saw the article that was in Menopause last month, Louise Newson's study, and I did a Substack article on that too, where basically she looked at women that were using transdermal estrogen and measuring estrogen levels and finding that about 20% of them had much, much lower levels than is expected. And this is something that, I mean, any one of us who've been in practice for a long time has had those patients that you're giving them transdermal estrogen and they're still flashing. And then while we don't get levels routinely, we get a level and then it's like lower. So what are your thoughts on that? Does this make you feel like maybe we should be checking levels more often in women who are continuing to be symptomatic?
Certainly. And I do that already. I mean, if we somehow just can't, you know, make one or two adjustments, but if we just can't get them to a happy place, I definitely check an estradiol level, right? There are different FDA approved options that we have in our toolbox. And I think it's really important to be flexible. And if one doesn't seem to be working, go to a different type and see if they're not absorbing the patch or they don't seem to be responding, go to the gel. The other thing I want to point out is applying the patch properly. I literally will demonstrate on my own body. I show them my patch, you know, how to actually apply that patch properly on a nice, flat, clean, dry surface, and, you know, rub your finger over the top, make sure there are no wrinkles and that it's really attached to the skin properly, so that the absorption can be optimal. The other thing I may want to point out too is that, and I've noticed this more and more, but the generic patches, and some patients really do feel a difference from one patch type to the next. Have you seen that, by the way, when they change their generic patches, that they all of a sudden have breakthrough symptoms when they were fine on one type, and then they, what are the different, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's funny, because that's actually the next question from someone from Anne.
Really? Okay,
and this was a question that was called in through my website, and she wants to know if it's okay to substitute a brand name patch with a generic patch. And I mean, you just gave the answer. Sometimes it's okay, but sometimes it's not. And and there are differences. You can have the exact same active ingredient. You know, they all have estradiol, but the actual patch and the what's called the vehicle that it's in is slightly different, and it may make a difference. So yeah, if you are switching to a generic patch and suddenly you're not feeling the same, or you're flashing, you're not sleeping, it may be that it's just not absorbing, and it's worth getting a level. I think the other thing also, and you've mentioned this, but just to emphasize, a lot of people, if they choose to use a transdermal product, they're just told, oh, use the patch because those are the least expensive and they've been around for a long time. But we have a lot of other transdermal options that someone might absorb more, like, you know, the gels and sprays and the vaginal ring. And that's one of the problems with not seeing a menopause expert is very often they have like one prescription in their toolbox. And then if you don't do well on that, they don't really have any place to go.
Personalized medicine and the art of medicine, like you're really dealing with an individual and all their variables and their priorities. And then this toolbox that you have to be really flexible with, right? You really have to listen to what their concerns are and what things aren't working and what are, and then make adjustments. It's really, it takes a lot of, listening and.
But it goes beyond it's having things in your toolbox. I mean, too many people. I just took a question earlier in this webinar I was doing that this woman said she went to see her doctor and said she wanted hormone therapy, and the doctor agreed and just wrote her a prescription. And she said, I wasn't given any options. I was just given this one. Should I have been given options? And I'm like, absolutely. Because first of all, you may have had medical issues that made one thing a better option than something else, or, you know, might have been a personal preference, but there's so many different formulations and they're all very, very different. And I think one of the things that's out there, which is slightly problematic, is everyone has this idea that everyone should be on transdermal, you know, and that never should be on oral. And that's just not true. There are some people that are much better candidates for oral than transdermal.
The issue with the transdermal versus oral, as we both know, right, is the clotting risk. But if you really break it down to the absolute numbers, these we're talking about minimal risk, right? 2 in 1,000 versus 3 to 4 in 1,000 risk.
Right. I mean, people hear double the risk and they panic. And I'm like, okay, but it's like double the risk of getting struck by lightning. If it's only 1 in 1,000,000, then it's 2 in 1,000,000. It's really not that much when you, like you said, you got to look at the absolute numbers. I want to go back to the absorption thing though, because I think that this is really a much bigger problem. And we talk about, you mentioned about making sure that the patch is really sticking well, which is super important, but there's other things that people can do to make sure they're getting maximum absorption. And one of them is if they're using a gel or a spray, if you wash too soon after that, like within an hour, you're not going to get the full amount. So I don't know if you have any tricks or tips to make sure that you are getting the biggest bang out of your transdermal estrogen.
After the shower, when you're making your cappuccino and there's a little bit of time, put it on your pant leg, or, you know, you rub it on your arm or your forearm or your, or
depending on the product, right?
Right. Depending on the product, wherever you're applying it. And then, you know, walk around and make sure you're not putting clothing on over the top. I had a patient who I showed her how to do it. We talked about it, but, and I just couldn't get her levels up. And finally she came into the office and I said, show me how you put it on. She lifts up her jeans and her calf is covered with the lint from her jeans. And she was putting the testosterone on her calf as I instructed, and then throwing her blue jeans down. And she looked at me and she goes, well, it looks like my jeans have been absorbing all the testosterone. So they're having a lot more. I mean, and we giggled, you know, it was very fun.
Yeah, her jeans had a great libido. Yeah.
So that waiting for it to absorb properly is really important, right? To your point, don't shower an hour afterwards.
Another thing also, and I'm sure you've seen this data, people that use a gel or a spray, and then if they have pets and they're sitting there and cuddling their pets, not only is their pet going to start to grow breasts, seriously, has been reported, but it also means that they're losing some of their estrogen to their pet. So people need to be aware of that.
Don't share it, right? Yeah.
Don't share it.
I'm sure.
All right, next question. Yeah. I'm 62. My last period was 13 years ago. Is it too late for me to start hormone therapy?
There's not as if some big guillotine comes down at the age of 60. We talk about, you know, symptoms and risks. We do know that an early start gets you the most benefit, right? Within that first 10 years. Is there still some benefit at 63? It just depends on what the patient's symptoms are, what her goals are, what are her bones look like, right? We know that it does help with the osteoclast, inhibits those osteoclasts and bone loss. Just depends, right?
Well, I'm 100% agreement, but I think the thing that really needs to be stressed is why? Why does this woman want to start hormone therapy? There's a big difference between the woman who says, I'm still flashing and I can't sleep and it's not getting any better. And the answer is, yeah, then let's talk about this, because for some women, hot flashes are 10, 12 years or forever. So it's reasonable to talk about it. But the one that's a little trickier is the woman who says, I sleep like a baby. I don't have any hot flashes. My bones are terrific. I have just been seeing all over social media that this is going to keep me from getting heart disease down the road. So I want to start hormone therapy. You know, what do you think? And for me, the answer is, you know, if you're not flashing and if you're sleeping, you're probably not going to get a whole lot out of it. And let's really look at what are your goals? What are your symptoms? Why are you thinking of doing this? So it's not that I think it's a bad idea. I don't always think it's a necessary idea. So it kind of depends.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And also, this was, of course, the big flaw in the WHI study was that the average age of those women was 60, and many of them had they had cardiovascular disease already in place. And then we put, you know, oral estrogen on top of existing cardiovascular disease, and then there were problems, right? So somebody who's 63 may, in fact, already have vascular vessel disease, right? So that's really important to make sure that that's not the case, that we won't cause any trouble. But I agree, there has to be, I spend a lot of time on those conversations and really do try to figure out what her goals are and why she wants to do it. You know, sexual health is, as I know, obviously you spoke.
Right, but a lot of time involved with vaginal estrogen will take care of that too. But it brings me back to your original point, is this is individualized medicine. This is personalized care. You know, it's not like we can make a blanket statement that says, sure, all 62-year-olds should go on estrogen. It's really about what is this person's goals and what's her medical history. All right, this one is actually something that is not uncommon. This is from Miriam. And she says that she's started using local vaginal estrogen and is loving it. Everything is going really well. Everything is great. But she's noticing that she's got kind of a smegma-like accumulation under her clitoral hood. So she wants to know how best to clean it. So what would you tell her?
Gently, very gently. Less is always better when it comes to the vagina. So keep it really simple. It's very gently. You know, just to retract that clitoral hood.
But I think really the most important part is water, water, water.
Water.
Do not put soap there. Do not put those liquid soaps. Do not use any of those so-called feminine hygiene products. All you need is to gently, as you said, retract the hood. And then if you've got one of those nice little shower heads, rinse it off. You might get a nice little orgasm while you're doing that. I'm just saying, you know.
Boner.
But the point is that whether you get in a bathtub or whether you use a shower head, stick to water. Don't use other products. Stick to water. And she didn't ask this, but the other thing is, what about the woman who is not able to retract her clitoral hood? Because we see this sometimes post-menopause that someone has a hood that doesn't just slide easily over the clitoris. So what would you tell her?
You would need to see somebody who can take a look and see if there's some adhesions there. And then that's something that can be treated fairly straightforwardly right in the office with topical anesthesia.
If it needs to be. That's the caveat. Let's back up. Because a lot of women have a clitoral hood that is not easily going to slide off the clitoris. And if they're not having pain, if they're not having irritation, if they're not having problems, that's okay. That's a normal variation. But to your point, they need to be examined to make sure that there's not lichen sclerosis or something else going on. But not, I just want to be clear that yes, there is a procedure that can be done in the office to get rid of any scar tissue, any adhesions, but everybody doesn't need that. That's only 100%. If someone is having problems.
Problems and, you know, with orgasm, right? Those clitoral adhesions can impair that orgasm. But yes, 100%. But the, maybe just to start with an exam with a gynecologist who's mm-hmm. comfortable with that sort of thing to take a look just to see if yeah. if anything could be helpful. But yes, absolutely. Yeah. Don't need
but,
to go.
But I think the real message is that you need to, just like guys who aren't circumcised, they need to pull back on their foreskin and to clean their penis. And, you know, penis Same is idea. Just a big clitoris. And so it's really very, very similar. But I think the other point is someone might be saying, well, why is she getting all this estrogen on her clitoris, under the clitoral hood? And the answer is, and they actually have an entire episode on this in Come Again, about the idea of using a local vaginal estrogen, not just in the vagina, but on the vulva, including on the clitoris, because it increases blood flow, it increases sensitivity, it can actually help with orgasm. So we tell women all the time, you know, take a little estrogen cream and put it on your clitoris, but then you do need to be mindful about making sure that you are cleansing it appropriately so that you don't get any buildup there.
And whenever I write a prescription for topical estrogen cream, which is daily, multiple times a day, I say insert into the vagina and then a glob pearl size amount on the fingertip, and that goes on the vulva, the clitoris, all the important parts.
So you're so, and then maybe a little bit on your face while you're at it, but that's a different topic.
That is a different topic, but yes.
Okay. Colleen wants to know, is it okay to put vaginal lubricant inside the vagina?
I don't see why not. I don't have any problem with that. The only thing I like to say about lube is just pH compatible, right?
I'm more concerned about osmolality than pH, quite frankly.
Are you really? Yeah. Okay. So, I have patients that love coconut oil, for example, and I don't think that's pH compatible with the vagina particularly. But
this is my take on that. You know, I'm glad that she's differentiating between using lubricant on the vulva and the opening of the vagina versus actually putting it inside the vagina. And we know that some things are vagina friendly and some things are not vagina friendly. So you mentioned coconut oil. My right. take on that is if you use it for making lunch, don't use it for making love, because it is not pH compatible. It's right. oily. It can cause an increase in bacterial vaginosis. It's fine in a pinch, but it's not something you should be using regularly. But, and I don't know if not everyone knows this, but what's really interesting is these products, of course, are not FDA approved. They're FDA cleared. And in order to get FDA clearance to put something in the vagina, you have to test it on either humans or animals. So usually it's, you know, little rat vaginas that get the benefit of all this. But this is how you know. If you buy a product and the word vagina is on the label, if it says vaginal lubricant, that means it has been FDA cleared. It has been tested that it's not going to cause problems in the vagina, and you can use as much in the vagina as you want. If it has one of these ridiculous euphemisms like feminine or whatever, who knows? And I wouldn't put any of that stuff in the vagina because you don't know what you're getting. And I mentioned osmolality. You know, most of the water-based lubricants have a very high osmolality, which means if you put a lot in the vagina, you can get all kinds of inflammation, irritation. It can actually dry out the vagina. So it depends. So my approach is use a silicone lubricant, and you can put a whole bucket full in your vagina. It's just fine because it's not going to cause any harm to the tissue. It's not going to alter osmolality. It's not going to cause pH problems. Some people really want to get it inside there. You can go to Amazon and get one of these lube shooters, which is just like a nice little big plastic syringe. You can load it up and shoot it in there. But the point is if it's truly a vaginal lubricant that is vagina friendly and has been tested to be okay in the vagina, well, then sure, go for it. But I think the best delivery system to get vaginal lubricant in the vagina is a penis or a toy, whatever you're using, you know, put it all over the toy, and then it's going to get in there.
Exactly. Oh, well, that was excellent. I learned some things just now.
So about the rats in the vagina. Yeah.
What did you say you could, the rats? What did you say you could buy off Amazon?
It's a lubricant shooter.
Yeah, okay.
You actually can load it up.
No,
and for a lot of women who are feeling, especially if they're in a new relationship and they're feeling uncomfortable about the whole that they need lubricant thing, I mean, hopefully they communicate with their partner and get past that. But if they can't, you know, and you go to the bathroom and you use your lube shooter and you shoot it in there and he has no idea that it's not all you. So there's that.
I love that.
All right. So this next question actually came in from two people, Christy and Angela, kind of the same question, a little bit different version. And both of these women have a history of endometriosis and now they're in menopause and they want to know if they start hormone therapy, is that going to trigger a recurrence of their endometriosis?
So I had somebody recently who had big endometriosis surgery, and I called the surgeon. We talked about it. It was deep infiltrating, and she wanted her to kind of have a period of time where she had nothing. And then we started hormones maybe 3 months later. If it's been a long time from their last period, if they haven't had any symptoms, and certainly using both estrogen and progesterone, right, to suppress any potential resurgence. I don't know. What do you do in this situation? I tell them that I don't think we have a lot of data on recurrence, right?
Well, we have some data, and the data is really pretty reassuring. And my take on it is twofold. One is when you look at women that have endometriosis, one is it's not just the presence of estrogen, it's cycling. You know, when someone is having natural periods, and in fact, if they're on birth control pills, we put on continuous birth control pills so they don't have the cycle. And when we give postmenopause hormone therapy, we're giving continuous estrogen. But the other point is that we are giving it in dramatically lower doses. That's why we don't use the term hormone replacement therapy, because we're not replacing estrogen. We're not giving you the same kind of levels that you had when you were 20. We're using very, very low doses of estrogen to get rid of symptoms. So my feeling is if someone has a history of endometriosis and wants to take postmenopause estrogen, go for it. We use a low dose. We use it continuously. Obviously, we're going to monitor these people, but I think it's okay. And I know that this is somewhat controversial because we don't have as much data as we would like, but I will tell you that in years of doing this, it was fine. And keep in mind also, these are often very young women, especially if they have a hysterectomy because of their endometriosis. And if they have ovary removal, they're plunged into a menopause at a very young age, which puts them at the highest risk of having long-term problems like osteoporosis and cardiovascular disease. So my inclination is, no, we're not going to deprive you of estrogen for the rest of your life just because you had endometriosis.
Right. And I totally agree. And this patient was really young, 46, I think, that they go through. And it holds, as you say, all those risks with regard to brain, bone, and heart. Despite not having a uterus, I put both on estrogen and progesterone, maybe to just that continuous suppression situation. But yes, I agree.
I don't do that, but you're not the only person who I've heard say that. It's even if they don't have a uterus, that's going to suppress endometriosis more. And I don't, it's an interesting thought. I don't know that we have that data.
I'm sure we don't.
So, and it's data that we're not going to get. People are like, well, why don't people do these studies? Well, first of all, the people that are motivated to do studies are pharmaceutical companies that are trying to get a product through. So that's not the case. And now we have complete defunding of women's health and the NIH and on and on and on. So I think we are going into a very dark period of not having anyone who's funding these non-pharma type studies. So every once in a while.
They say, you know, this is sort of a data-free zone or we don't have much information and patients get really frustrated. And it's always, I always try to explain, you know, there's no funding for it. And that's always a hard,
I think that's where people like you and I come in because we do have decades of experience. Experience does count for something to say. I've had many, many women in this kind of a scenario, and I've given them estrogen with endometriosis, and they do just fine, or with your experience of giving progesterone as well. So there's something to be said for not being new in this field. All right. This one's from Rochelle, who is taking an oral estrogen. And she's curious. She has high cholesterol and wants to know if this is the best hormone therapy for her in terms of her high cholesterol, or should she be using a transdermal? So what would you tell her?
Right. Interesting. So, you know, we probably need to know a little bit more about her lipid panel, I suppose. So oral estrogen actually has been shown to decrease LDL. It can increase triglycerides, right? It can interfere there. So it can actually have a kind of a favorable impact on the lipid profile. Maybe look into her clotting risk potentially, and just see if there are any issues there. But I would need a little more information from her.
It's always good to have more data, but I think overall, assuming that she doesn't have a risk of blood clots, we know that both oral estrogen and transdermal estrogen are going to decrease cholesterol. That's clear cut. Right. Everyone agrees. Yeah. It turns out the oral estrogens decrease total cholesterol more than the transdermals, much to some people's surprise. But oral estrogens increase triglycerides and transdermals decrease triglycerides. So exactly to your point, we need to know the whole lipid panel. But if we're just talking total cholesterol, then yeah, an oral estrogen is an excellent option for her. And people generally see a significant decrease in their total cholesterol when they go on an oral estrogen.
Yeah. And that oral estrogen, it gets demonized a little bit, right?
Yeah, absolutely underutilized because like I said, everyone, this is the idea that transdermal is always better, which in some cases it is, and it is safer. But keep in mind that we talk about the fact that estrogen decreases the risk of breast cancer by around at least 21% or more. Those studies were all done with oral estrogen. And while we assume that you're going to get some of the same benefit with transdermal, we do not have as good data. And if people are particularly worried about breast cancer, and I tell them, we want to put you on the estrogen that's going to decrease your risk the most, we're looking at oral and specifically at Duavay, which is the one that has bazodoxifen, which I've talked about so many times, I don't think I need to go there again, but you know, it was also going to be breast protective. Okay, this one's super easy. This will just take you a second. We get this question all the time. Is it safe to take systemic estrogen and local estrogen at the same time?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. And I get this. I'll tell you who I get the question from.
The pharmacists.
They drive me crazy. I'm like, please stop sending me messages on the EMR. Or they block the patient at the pharmacy. They say, you can't take both of these. So the answer very simply is yes.
Yes.
So women that are on systemic estrogen, whether transdermal or oral, about 50% of them will still need that topical estrogen.
Oh, I think it's even higher maybe. Yeah.
I do too. So yes, absolutely. You can treat with both. And I do all the time.
But it's funny. I mean, that's a question that comes up all the time. And it's because of the pharmacists and the insurance company that says, your doctor made a big mistake here. Don't do this. It's too much estrogen. And that's just not the case. But that's why we have to keep bringing it up because people do get this. Okay. This is from Coral. She had a hysterectomy last year because of uterine cancer. She wants to know if she can take estrogen.
Well, certainly topical estrogen for her vagina, right?
We're not talking about that. That's fine. We're talking about
systemic.
She's having hot flashes. Can she take us, you know, systemic?
Where I definitely would get on the call, you know, on a call with an oncologist and have a chat, right?
We always have to collaborate with our oncologist friends. But in general, and I can't tell Coral what to do because I don't know enough about her cancer, what they found. But in general, if someone has a stage one uterine cancer that's not a high-grade cancer, we have very good data that shows they are perfectly okay to take systemic estrogen. So this is one of those cases. This is a conversation between the oncologist and the gynecologist. It's the higher grade or the more advanced cancers that we don't have the data. It's not that we've seen that it's bad. It's that we just don't have the data to know if it's safe. But it's a great question because uterine cancer is the most common gynecologic cancer right now. And it's highly curable, over 95% curable, which is why women should never ignore any postmenopause bleeding. But a lot of women end up with a hysterectomy and then are told that they can't take estrogen, which is not always
not
true.
Not the case. Yes.
Not always true. Let's see. We had to rush through a few more because I know you got patients. You got to get out of here. But let's just do a couple more. All right. Taking low doses of testosterone, and I'm pretty sure my voice is getting lower. My doctor said my levels are fine. I thought that only happened with high doses. I don't know what to do. Should I go off and will it go back to how it was?
Oh, yep. They gave a great lecture about this at the Menopause Society this past year. And I don't know that I think what we've seen in the data is that we, even at lower doses, they can have some voice changes, which is obviously devastating for certain people in certain professions, right? Sure. Singers and things like that. It's something that has to go along with the counseling, that it is something that can happen. And unfortunately, the data also shows that it's irreversible.
It's usually irreversible. But Exactly. I heard that same lecture and it really changed what I've told people, because in the past I always said, you don't have to worry about your voice getting lower as long as we're really careful about the levels and we keep them nice and low. And this otolaryngologist basically said, that's not the case. She sees women all the time who are on appropriate dosages, and particularly like, you know, actors, voiceover, opera singers, they're going to notice even these subtle changes, but it is a big issue. And along with the potential for hair growth or acne, people need to be told that you might get some voice changes. And for some people, they need, you know, that's a deal breaker. They need to know that in advance. They need to know that in advance. I'm 45 years old, scheduled for a hysterectomy because of fibroids. Is my sex life going to change? Just want to make that point. A lot of people think that if they have a hysterectomy that they go into menopause, and you do not. A hysterectomy is removal of the uterus. And if you don't have removal of the ovaries, nothing changes hormonally. So this woman is like, my uterus is coming out, but not my ovaries. And I want to know, is this going to impact my sex life?
We do know, though, after hysterectomy like that, because of the disruption of some of the blood flow, there's all that collateral blood flow, that they can go into menopause earlier, right? After hysterectomy.
Or they're just, but you know, a lot of people, like, they're 50 and they say, I'm going to keep my ovaries. And it's like, you know, okay. And then they go into menopause and they think it's because of the hysterectomy, and it's because they were going to go into menopause anyway. No, anyway, but I think for the sake of this question, I think the real thing is nothing changes hormonally. And I actually just recorded a whole podcast episode on this for Come Again about women who have a hysterectomy and do have a change in their sex life. It's the exception, not the rule. Most people, it's fine. But there are a lot of things that the uterus does when it comes to the sexual experience. I mean, when women have an orgasm, their uterus contracts. That's going to go away. Some people's cervical stimulation will even trigger an orgasm. So the short answer to that excellent question is that in most cases, no, it's not going to make a big change, but there are women that it will make a change. And so, you know, as I was researching that when I was doing this episode, we really have a lot of really interesting data about that. So it's a good question, because I got to tell you, surgeons do not bring that up.
They don't talk about it. The one thing I would say, like, my patients who are miserable with their fibroids, if they're getting hysterectomy, obviously they're terribly symptomatic, and it's probably kept them from having sex, or maybe they have pain with sex because of their fibroids.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, once they're treated, their sex life improves.
Oh my God, yes.
They feel so much better from the fibroid removal, right?
No, in fact, there's really good data that shows that women who have a hysterectomy because of pain, like endometriosis or bleeding because of fibroids, everything only gets better, not to mention the anemia. You know, if you're really anemic and tired, your sex life is going to be in the toilet. So there's that. All right, we're running out of time here. But I want to ask you before we go, are there any questions you've gotten recently that you think are worth mentioning?
I got a message on the portal and she said, you know, I'm getting a rash in my armpit. And I'm like, a rash in your armpit. And she goes, does it have anything to do with my hormone therapy? And I'm thinking, well, I don't think so, but it required a lot of back and forth. But finally, I finally figured out she was putting her patch in her armpit. That's where she was sticking the patch. So that was
unusual. It just sounds uncomfortable.
I mean, right? I'm not sure why or how or where she got that idea, because I certainly never told her that. And also, we do, for transdermal particularly, we don't want that near the breast, right?
They always say that, but come on. There's no data. That's fear-mongering that if you have estrogen, it's going to cause breast cancer. So that's an insane, you know, we are told that. Yes, don't put it near your breast, but there's no medical reason why they've been told that. And there's never been one single study that shows if you put your estrogen in the vicinity of your breast that it's going to cause breast cancer. And I think it's just really...
Exactly. Once again, no data to support it. And just, yeah, there's so much fear surrounding the subject, right? I spend my whole day trying to dispel that fear and give reassurance.
Sarah Larson, who's a menopause coach, and she sent me a question about how do we talk to our patients and to her clients and all this when they're getting all these mixed messages from these, you know, experts on social media. And of course, my response to that is stop going to social media for your medical care. But, you know, I've done a few podcasts on that, and it is highly problematic because people are getting a lot of information and then they go to their own doctor who isn't necessarily helpful. So I will, in the program notes, as always, put information about where to find a menopause expert. In the program notes, I will also list all of the ways that I can get your questions so that either on one of my once a month Ask Me Anything webinars for my Substack subscribers, or if we do another one of these, that we can get your questions answered. So check the program notes and I will put all of the links and all the information there. And I want to thank you so much. It was so nice to have you here because I'm used to just kind of doing this myself and I get tired of hearing my own voice. So it was really nice to be able to share this with someone else. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me. And if you're looking for more inside information, check out my Substack. Just go to drstriker.substack.com. And you can also follow me on Instagram @drstrike.